It's Wednesday, October 27th, Philosophy 201, Ethics, Fall 2010. And we were talking last time about Nozick's experience machine. So someone want to tell me, first of all, what is Nozick's experience machine supposed to prove? This is a thought experiment. What's Nozick's point in raising this hypothetical piece?
Evan. That people don't only value pleasure or happiness.
And so what is the name of the view that that disproves?
Hedonism.
Yeah, so Nozick's point is that hedonism is false. Why I want to bring the statue and not just my computer. Hedonism is false, and he thinks that the experience machine shows that. Experience machine shows this. And how does somebody else want to explain to me, how does the experience machine show that hedonism is false? Maybe give me like a capsule summary, or someone just explain to me what the experience machine is. What is it? What's the thought experiment that we talked about last time? What's your name, Lizzie? Tony?
Tony.
Tony, right. Go ahead.
It's just getting into a place or a machine where you experience nothing but pleasures. There's no worries. Everything in the outside world is taken care of. And you can set this program up however you'd like, just experience pleasures and happiness.
A life of happiness, of complete and utter happiness. Most people think that seems pretty good. But when you think it through, the question is, would there be anything that was missing? And what some people raised some things last time that were missing. Like sometimes I think people that initially think it would be a bad deal do it because they really don't think it would work. And that's kind of cheating on the experiment. If you say, well, if there's too much happiness, then I wouldn't be happy. if you think to be maximally happy, you need some unhappiness mixed in there for variety, I think you're wrong. But if that's what's going to make you happy, mix in filling out some boring reports in between shooting aliens. If you think that the fight and the aliens or exploring new worlds will be all the more exciting if you do hours of boring paperwork as you would realistically, you know, in Star Trek. Why does Star Trek not have long scenes with Picard there drinking his Earl Grey tea and filling out reports, because it's really boring television. Nobody wants to watch that, right? They have like 2 seconds of it, and then somebody comes in his door and introduces the problem. Instantly, you got drama. And why is drama exciting? Why do people like drama? Well, it's the building and releasing of tension that gives us pleasure when we watch dramatic action. So, you know, that's one of the things that you probably want to build into your happiness scenario. But then the question is, if you had a life of complete and utter fantasy and all your desires were fulfilled and you were completely happy, would that be an ideal life? And if not, what sorts of things would be missing other than pleasure and happiness? What makes your life valuable? Or what do you find value in addition to those things? You have any ideas?
I wrote about it on the forum, but I wouldn't mind being hooked up for a little while just to escape now and then. But
right.
In reality, things like, for me, spending time with my son every day as he's growing, you know, they're not all perfect, but there's unexpected things that you might not think about to program into a pleasure machine that are, I call them unexpected, you know. think.
Well, you could have somebody like programming random things, though.
Yeah.
So I think the program's supposed to be, can program in any pleasurable experience. So when lottery, you could, like, I mean, it could even program in your, you're having a great day with your son in the backyard throwing the ball back and forth, and it's the perfect temperature, and all of a sudden you notice the sun kind of glinting off the trees in a certain way, and it's like, wow, that's cool. You know, like, you can program stuff like that into your scenario. You can even, you know, tell the programmers, surprise me every day with something, you know, cool. And so, but that relationship isn't something that could exist in the machine. Now, you could have the pleasure that you get from the relationship, but the relationship wouldn't be real. So there would be some computer simulation which would make it seem as if your son was there. But it would be like a dream, right? I don't know if you people who have partners that you sleep in the same bed with, and sometimes the partner will wake up after a nightmare and say, how could you, and start hitting you, and you're like, what, I didn't do anything, like, I had this dream and you were out with this floozy and you laughed in my face, I'm like, that wasn't me, that was just a dream, right? So there's not a real person there, but when you're in the dream it seems like it's real. And so it would be a representation of your son, but there wouldn't be any real relationship. You would just get the pleasure that you would get from that relationship, but the relationship wouldn't be real.
So what was missing? Real relationships would be, you know, be something that would be missing.
But I think, like, for surprises could be built in there. Yeah.
Actually, one of the things I was noticing is with Mills in the book, he was saying that...
No S in Mill. John Stuart Mill.
Oh, okay.
That's all right. I just want to nip that right in the bud. Go ahead. But John Stuart Mill, no S. Go ahead.
But said that there was multiple different factors that comprised a person being able to be happy. You know, that it wasn't just the singular pursuit of a pleasure. It was the combination of all of life's pleasures put together. And with the Nozick experience machine, the reason why people don't want to go into it is just because they feel like they're sacrificing something that's pleasurable to them, namely the connections that they have with the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were to take somebody that had never had any life experience and therefore wasn't sacrificing anything, because sacrifice is the key component for making this a difficult decision. If there was no sacrifice, probably could argue people would be happy in a place like that.
By sacrifice, you mean giving up something you value?
Giving
like
up
right now?
Your family? I mean, yeah, you know you'll have a simulation, but you'll also know it's not your family.
Well, you know, you won't know that. You'll think it's your family.
Well, up until the point you get in the machine, which means you won't be willing to get into the machine.
Oh, yeah. So people will think, I'll have to give up my real family, but I'll get a simulated family, and I won't know the difference between the two.
And then that brings into the argument whether or not people could be consciously and unconsciously happy or unhappy. Because, I mean, whether or not you knowingly know that it's a simulation, what if your subconscious knows that it's a simulation and you never get a moment's peace because of it?
Let's assume that the programmers could work that way out. So happiness includes conscious and, if there is such a thing, unconscious happiness. So they can, like, monitor your brain waves, and they can say, oh, there's some trouble, I see some anxiety, it looks like something's going on, let's plan a bunch of hypnotic suggestions, or, you know, whatever they do. Some science-y thing they do to fix that. So again, it's a thought experiment. So what we want to do is get to the principle apart from, like, the practicalities, and focus on the philosophical question, which is, you know, is happiness all there is to life? Yes, sir.
I think that Nozick's experience machine, one of the main downfalls is that you wouldn't benefit society in any way. You'd be basically worthless for society because all that you're worried about is what pleasures you. And if everybody was hooked up to this, how, for example, I have an uncle who, he was working recently, and even though he was working long hours, you know, 50, 60 hour weeks, when you were around him, he was a very vibrant, very happy person.
Uh-huh.
He's been laid off for quite a while now, and yes, he's it's not like they're struggling financially, but he has the ability to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. But he doesn't seem like he's a happy person, I think, because mainly he's not as productive.
Uh-huh.
That's
yeah, so
my example of why people would want to be in a machine. Because it's an inability to benefit society, is what I would say.
Productivity. Actually benefiting others. And you can work into the situation here where you could like have, you know, a simulation of benefiting others where you're like a big philanthropist giving away millions of dollars to poor people, but it wouldn't be real. But you get the same warm, fuzzy feelings that you would as if it were real. And now the thing is that maybe you could like, this is supposed to be about what's valuable. What if like everyone had a chance to hook up to the machine? Would that change your mind about that? So, you know, suppose everyone gets their shot and they can choose to be hooked up or not. And you might figure, well, if somebody doesn't want to be hooked up, it's their loss. That, would you think?
I see what you're getting at, but still, I mean, imagine, so everybody could go do heroin, and I mean, everybody have a great time, everybody feel really good.
Uh-huh.
But what good is it to everybody as a collective group?
Yeah, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, that would be like saying that you would feel bad about accepting the winnings from a lottery because you didn't earn the money.
Not necessarily. I'm saying there is happiness in productivity.
But that isn't, like I was saying, it's a lottery. If you win $10 million, you know, you would probably...
Is that person going to be happier than the person that works?
But would that person who won the lottery be unhappy?
I'm not saying they'd be unhappy, but you could find somebody that's happier that has to work their whole life for every dime they make.
Yeah, but I'm saying as far as the machine, you couldn't take people that would say like, oh, I'm not producing, I'm not being productive, so I'm not going to take advantage of the machine. Well, that'd be like saying, well, I didn't earn the money, and it's not anything I deserve, so I'm not going to take the lottery cash. It's like passing up on the lottery, it'd be like passing up on the machine.
Like a cynic might say that if you feel sort of funny not working, that maybe like if you won the lottery, you'd have like extra money to spend on therapy to get over the workaholism or something like that. I think I would be happier if I won the lottery, but a lot of people have actually they've done studies that show that people that get the win the lottery, they tend to squander the money and end up being in the same position that they were in like 5 years, and they have a lot of bad stuff happening, and also they have the experience of being rich and having this big windfall, and so having you know a lot of money and then losing it, it creates a big it creates a lot of unhappiness in their life. So that at the end, many people will say they wish they never would have won. Which is interesting to me, Evan.
Okay, you brought up benefiting society, and I think this has a fundamental principle of progress being a value. So a utilitarian or utilitarian. Would say that you would help society in that the happier you are, the happier society is as a whole. And so the most benefit you could give society is to be as happy as you can.
Yeah, if you think about like, and again, this machine's trying to make think of it tense. The way the machine's set up, each person's in their own little world. Nothing is real except for the happiness. But you tweak the scenario all you like to take care of, like, well, what about other people? Because this is trying to get you to figure out what's a value in general. And then you can think, okay, what should be done with that value? So this is you have the theory of value and theory of action. Theory of value in utilitarianism is hedonism. And so there's this question, is hedonism right or wrong? Are there other values besides pleasure or happiness? But then after you figure out that, you come to the theory of action. Like, once you figure out what's valuable, what should you do? And, you know, utilitarians say, well, just maximize whatever is of value. So they have a consequential theory of value. And you can talk about that separately. So the idea is to try to have a narrow focus on what really is valuable. And think about things like knowledge or freedom. Do I want to know things because they help me do other things that allow me to be happy, or do I want to know things for the sake of knowing them? Is there, like, I think about sometimes I read about things that have little practical value. What might be an example? What was I reading about? Anybody read something of little practical value the other day? Something about stamp collecting, or I don't know.
I don't know. It certainly wasn't practical to my life, but it was like something about how frog legs work with like salt or something. Uh-huh. And like they did an experiment where they had just frog legs and then they put salt and then the legs would twitch. And, yeah, it was
right.
It was interesting but trivial.
And I suppose you have you're some kind of biology me that fits in there generally, but it's probably, you know, in the larger scheme of things, not too practical. Like, I was reading another article on anti-aging medicine and insulin growth factor, and how it looks like insulin resistance is related to aging, and how if you eat fewer simple carbohydrates and fewer foods which are low on the glycemic index, it creates less of an insulin response and turns on this gene called the sweet 16 gene, DAF16. I'm like, ooh, this is really interesting. And so, and the experimenter was talking about how she ate, like, you know, green vegetables and a little bit of meat, but was staying away from the carbohydrates, and gave all these reasons. And I still want to go back and read it some more, but to me that's interesting because I want to live as long as I can. And so that might actually be something I could, might be a practical benefit for me. On the other hand, you know, I read a story, you know, I'm poking around the internet and I might read a story about, I'm trying to think of what I was reading last night. Just like something, you know, I'm on the Facebook or whatever, I'm looking at some interesting thing. Politics, a lot of politics is kind of useless, or I don't know, just some trivial, yeah.
Yeah, the situation, some guy that has a show has some new book out about relationships. You know, and they were saying how, you know, definition, they read off one definition of what to do on a date from some guy who's, you know, in my opinion, totally out of touch with reality anyway. It was like that, to me, was something that, you know, who would even be interested in?
Now, the other day I was reading about Chinese mythology, right? And I was interested in, there's this question you get in Chinese mythology, there's this god heaven, and he's called Shangdi, and there's this other god who's like kind of a sky god called Tian, and they seem to have merged at some point. And this Wikipedia article was describing Chinese religion as being monotheistic, which to me seemed to be a mistake. And so I was kind of reading up on this Chinese religion because I'm kind of interested in it. Now, do I think that, you know, does Chinese religion have a practical effect on my life? Well, it's kind of sort of related to my job because I teach religion classes, although I haven't taught the Asian religion classes in years, so it's not going to be like I'm going to have to teach this stuff, but I'm kind of interested in religion. So now the question is, do I want to find out this stuff about Chinese religion because I want to understand religion more, or is it just because I find it interesting and fun? And if I'm going to read what's most interesting and fun, you know, maybe I should be like reading a sci-fi site because I find sci-fi more interesting than religion overall or something like that. Or is it like, and I'm kind of interested in quantum physics. I want to understand how the world works. And I think that I want to understand how the world works because I want to know the truth about the world. The fact that I find it interesting to me is sort of incidental. Isn't it good to just know things, to know true things about the world? And the abstract facts of quantum theory probably aren't going to help me in my day-to-day life. If I want to help myself practically, maybe I should be studying economics, or maybe even not economics. Actually, I'm really interested in macroeconomics. Macroeconomics is not going to help you make a bunch of money. There's a bunch of people who make millions and even billions of dollars who just have totally wrong views of macroeconomics. George Soros is a perfect example. He's a billionaire who has absolutely no understanding of macroeconomics, but he's found a way to make lots of money. But so the question is, you know, should I spend my time on more practical things? But I think, in my view, it's good to know and understand things. And it's good to know and understand the department of happiness that brings me. If that's my view, then I'm not a hedonist. But is that a wrong view to have? Or would you say, well, you're just, you find that interesting, and so that's what's interesting to you, and so that's what makes you happy, and that's the only reason that you should even study these things if you find it interesting. And if you found economics boring, you wouldn't be reading it. Thoughts? Evan?
That kind of seems like it's like the psychological egoism. It's falling into the realm of unfalsifiable.
Perhaps so, yeah. Well, let me put this in the form of a question. Is it good just to know things of no practical value just for the sake of knowing them? Can knowledge be an end in itself? Or should you only seek knowledge if it brings you pleasure in the sense of like a hobby or you find it innately interesting, or it brings you some practical value, which is going to eventually lead to some happy state there, right? I study investing, I make some investment, and I make money, right? And I make the money, and it makes me happy. I use the money to buy things that make me happy, or so I don't have to work, or so I can retire in Costa Rica and live on the beach, or whatever I want to do, right? But I use it, it's a means to an end. And the end is always happiness, the hedonist view. That you have a sort of chain of things, one leads to the other. The end of the road is always going to be so I can be happy. Whereas, if you agree with Nozick, you say, well, there are other ends, which are ends in themselves, which don't involve happiness, like knowledge. Or you might put art. A lot of tortured artists out there. Some people argue that if you look at musicians, once they like make a bunch of money and they settle down and maybe get married and have some kids and get fat, dumb, and happy, their music sucks. Or they do their edgy, indie stuff at the beginning, and then the money starts coming their way, and then they put out this commercial crap. You know, people complain about this incessantly. And it sounds overproduced, and it gets, they want to sell to as many people as possible, and so they kind of water it down. And so a lot of people argue that some of the best artists are people who are tortured souls. And some people think that it's necessary to suffer for art's sake, to like think about all those negative experiences. Like to perform a tragedy, you need to like, if you're an actor, you have to, people sometimes will like try to dredge up like the worst thing that ever happened to them. So they really start crying on stage. And people have their little tricks to do that so they can convey that emotion as part of the character. Well, that requires you to suffer, right? So that doesn't seem like it's good. But the idea is you suffer for art's sake. Good art doesn't match your sofa. You need to say something. And sometimes good art should make people feel like crap. It should, and sometimes thinking is hard work, right? So the idea is that if you're a hedonist, and this is, we'll see, Mill tries to go against this objection. If you're a hedonist, it seems like you should be watching reality TV and eating pizza and playing video games, and that should be your life. You never crack open a philosophy book or think about anything in any depth. Because that's typically hard work. I don't know, thoughts? Somebody else want to chime in on this? On the experience machine? Anything related to it? Other values are missing here that have nothing to do with happiness? Shall we move on? Okay, let's move on here. So Nozick. Nozick, I'd also actually like to recommend, I think Robert Nozick is an excellent philosopher, and he has a book called Anarchy, State, and Utopia that I recommend to anybody interested in political philosophy. It's a response to John Rawls' book, A Theory of Justice, and I think it's one of the most important books in philosophy ever written. Apart from maybe this, there's a book by Murray Rothbard, which is similar, he gives a kind of a minarchist interpretation of political philosophy. But it's an important answer to John Rawls' theory of justice, which you may have run into in your political theory class. But it's, since we're talking about Nozick, anarchy, state, and utopia. Utopia. And it's an answer to John Rawls' theory of justice. And then there's another book by anarchist Murray Rothbard, responding to Nozick, saying that he doesn't go far enough, and that really you get rid of the state altogether. I think his is called Rothbard. His is called Man's State in Utopia. Nice fun bedtime reading. So, utilitarianism. Where's my bedroom slide? Where's my bedroom? It's skipping one of my slides here. Let me just see what's going on here. Second. So Jeremy Bentham is the founder of utilitarianism. Dates there, 1748 to 1832. The founder of utilitarianism. He created something called the hedonic calculus. So in the hedonic calculus, you think about a particular action you might perform. You add up all the pleasures on one column. You add up all the pains in another column with all the consequences of that action. And you look at the balance of pleasure with pain. You get at some sort of guesstimate of the net pleasure that action will bring you. And then you decide whether or not you should do it. And when considering that action, you want to also include all other possible alternative actions you might perform instead of that action. And what you want to do is create the action which will produce the maximum amount of pleasure. So hedonic comes from the word hedonism. Sometimes it's called the hedonistic calculus. But the idea is to kind of try to calculate the consequences of action. If I go home and if I go out to the bad part of town and score some heroin and go back to my apartment and shoot it up, what will be the consequences? You can think, well, I'll be out some money first of all, right? So I've got that in the pain column. You start with the pleasure column, right? So the pleasure column is like, well, I'll satiate my curiosity about heroin, because I've always wondered, what's the big deal about heroin? It costs so much money. The government spends so much time trying to keep people from using heroin. What's all the hubbub about, bub? And so I think I'm going to try heroin. So that's, you know, and I watch like The French Connection. It's all about heroin dealers. Maybe I have a kind of romantic notion about heroin. And so I'm like, I'm going to try heroin. And so that's going to satiate my curiosity, you know. What else might be good about shooting heroin? The rush, right? I'm going to get some pleasurable physical sensation. My whole body, I'm going to feel it, like intense pleasure going on in my brain. So that would be good. I don't know, anything else? I guess that's pretty much it about heroin, right? It's the rush. It's not like the cool people you meet doing heroin, right? It's not... So, okay, what about the pain side? What do we have to put in the pain column?
Withdrawals, money.
Yeah, so first of all, I got to pay money for it, and because it's against the law, I got to pay a lot of money for it. I run the risk of criminal prosecution. Maybe the guy I'm going to try to buy the heroin dealer from is like a government informant, and I'm going to be arrested for trying to buy heroin. Maybe my vehicle is going to be seized under government drug seizure laws. Maybe I'm going to get robbed in the bad part of town I have to go to find the heroin. So there's, and then once I like shoot up, it might be the best experience of my life, but that might be that I'll want to reproduce it over and over and over again. And then there's going to be like long-term health effects, and it's going to cost like a lot more money, and so all sorts of bad things. And so most people think that shooting heroin, according to Bentham, isn't wrong because God says not to do it. It's not wrong because there's something immoral with wanting to feel good for a while. It's not wrong because it's illegal, maybe, you know, something like, I'm not sure what, maybe someone like Rousseau would say you're violating the social contract. Hobbes maybe not. Hobbes might think that in an ideal government, you know, drugs would be illegal. But you know, if you think that it's wrong to break the law, that might be a reason. But he says shooting heroin is wrong because it creates long-term pain. And the likely consequences are going to overall be bad. So even in the short term, they might be good. Overall, they'll be bad. And anyone who reflects sufficiently on the consequences will see that shooting heroin will lead to pain. And so therefore, you shouldn't do it. So that'd be like an example of hedonic calculus. You'd say, oh, well, the short-term pleasure is outweighed by the long-term pain. Therefore, I shouldn't do this thing. Well, you know, what else could I do? And you can kind of go through the sorts of things you might do with your time as an alternative to shoot, going home and shooting heroin, like, you know, read a philosophy book, do your homework, look for a job, you know, and you sort of go through these things and you ask yourself, essentially like what Alan Lakin, the productivity expert, used to urge people to ask, and I guess still does, which is, what's the best use of my time now? What can I do right now to produce the most happiness, not just for the moment, but overall, you know, in the larger context of my life? What's going to make me the most happy? And so that's what the hedonic calculus does. So here's a picture of Jeremy Bentham. Bentham was kind of a joker. He presides to this very day over every meeting of the College of London. You might think, well, wait a minute, 1730, what was it? He died in the 1800s. How is he still presiding over meetings? Well, the bylaws of the College of London say that Bentham's stuffed corpse must be in attendance at every meeting. And that is his body stuffed with straw. The head is waxen. The actual head started looking kind of scary looking and Halloween-y looking, and so it's like in a bag underneath the chair. So there's a close-up of the wax head and his stuffed corpse. So kind of a joker, right? So, and Bentham is, you know, he's writing at a time where people are kind of stuffy, and you have like this bifurcation of classes that Montaigne talks about, where you have the very rich and the very poor. And Bentham thought, what you need is to people not think about in terms of like, well, what's fitting for my class, or what's fitting to my station in life, or what are my obligations given my position in society, right? He says you want to think about everybody. You want to think about the peasant. You want to think about the commoner. You want to think about not just your friends and family, you and yours. You want to think about the stranger in need, the widow and the orphan. And so his idea is the greatest good for the greatest number, the greatest happiness for people in general, not just for your station or your class or your group of people that and your family and friends and so on. So I think this endears me to Jeremy Bentham. I think this is, when I was a kid, this is what I wanted to do with my body. Now I'm going to feed freeze, but I don't know, maybe, I think I'll probably give away my organs and just have them freeze my head. But they didn't have crimes back when Bentham was around.
You'd be like a future model.
The technology's here. I think the people that go in today have a pretty good shot at it, but you can roll the dice with anything. Meets the alternative. So Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism, again, I shouldn't get ahead of my slides here. So he's a social reformer, reacting against the stratification of society. Stratification means layers. So you have the king at the top, and then the nobility, and then you have the sort of a merchant class below them. Then you got your workaday, blue collar workers, your laborers, and then below them you have like the peasants, and then maybe at the very bottom you have like beggars and prostitutes and homeless people and people on the very bottom. And Bentham said you need to benefit everyone. And when you think about your action, you shouldn't just think about your own narrow interests or those of your family and friends, but you should think about society in general. That's part of being a moral person, is having concern for other people and even people you don't even know. A kind of an impersonal principle that you want to advance the good of society. And the way you do that is by making people happy. And then he was a big supporter of education. as a means to that, and as a means of bringing people out of poverty and into a more of a middle class lifestyle. And this was kind of he saw the Hedonic Calculus as a practical way of thinking about how your decisions affected others, and whether your decisions were both good for you and good for society in general. A practical way, the Hedonic Calculus, a practical way of maximizing utility or happiness. Again, utility is net happiness. Take all the pleasure and all the pain, subtract all the pain, and you get some net happiness. Just like if you're in a business, right? You take your, or balancing your checkbook might be a better example. So you take all your credits, like from your paychecks you deposit, you subtract all the debits, the things that you use your debit card with or write a check for that you people are still living in the Stone Age, or you know, what have you, and then you get the amount left, and that's the net amount that you have left in your bank account. Or if you have a business, you take the total amount that you sell, you take out your expenses, and what's left is your profit. So you want to think about happiness as sort of like running your own business, and you always want to run as great a profit as you can. You want to minimize your expenses, the pains. You want to maximize your sales, the pleasures, right? And you want to get as much as possible. And there's two ways you can go, right? One, if you can focus on minimizing pain, and that's a way to do things. So one way to minimize pain might be to try to figure out how to pay for your taxes, right? So maybe you pay an accountant to do your taxes, or you use TurboTax, and you or your Google, and you figure out some scam where you can figure out how you can funnel your overseas earnings through Ireland, and then funnel the money over there from a shell corporation into the Netherlands. You pay 2.4% instead of 35%. Well, you're saving yourself a lot of pain, right? So that's a way of trying to minimize pain. You think about your daily life, you can do things like, what might be a practical way you would minimize pain?
Wear shoes?
Okay, yeah, I suppose that might be something, sure. I suppose it might be something like, carry an umbrella, or, get a new coat, or... But sometimes, you think about things that sort of annoy you every day. Maybe have some improvement they made in their life recently that brought them a great deal of pleasure, and not something besides something major. Could be something major. Stop smoking or something, right? Or lose some weight. Or you do something that even if you have a toothache, right, you go to the dentist and get it fixed. You minimize that pain. And then you think about, does that really seem like a moral decision? And for utilitarianism, there's not a strong distinction between moral and immoral. It might be that suppose you have some dispute with your neighbor. He's got a barking dog that keeps you awake at night, and you've got a bright light in your backyard to deter burglars. And maybe it turns out that the bright light is keeping the dog awake at night, who's sleeping in a heated doghouse in his backyard. So you get together and talk to the guy, and you realize this, and you make peace, and then you turn off the light and install a burglar alarm, and his dog maybe comes inside so he doesn't bark, or you make some arrangement, right? And that's something which is good. You make peace, and you don't have this, you don't feel angry, and you have maybe a friendship develops. So that would be a positive thing. So that's getting rid of the pain of a continual dispute with your neighbor. And then there's a way you can work on the pleasure thing, right? You can think, okay, what can I do that's more pleasurable? And so, and you can think, well, what gives me pleasure is, you think about doing something that would make your life more pleasant. For example, the month of October, I decided I would get in the spirit of Halloween and read some H.P. Lovecraft stories. So every night I read a scary story from H.P. Lovecraft about creatures from beyond time that blast your sanity and send you off to the insane asylum, or to suicide, and they've got tentacles and pseudopods, and it's kind of like a mixture of horror and sci-fi. And you know, I haven't done a lot of pleasure reading lately, so I'm like thinking to myself, what could I do that would be fun for Halloween? I'll read some of those old H.P. Lovecraft stories that I love so much, and you know, watch a couple of horror movies or something. So you kind of think about, and they don't have to be like weighty moral things or helping the poor. Again, this idea is that you want to create as much happiness for yourself as possible, and also other people. So you think about, like, how can you make your friends and family happy? How can I make my wife happier? How can if you have kids, how do you make them happier? And then you think about, like, the larger, you know, larger society, your community, you know, helping out the soup kitchen. You think about, like, maybe even your state or your country. And so you look at those little things, you know, people consider voting to be one of those things. Yeah.
So, you know, there isn't much of a distinction between moral and immoral. But would someone who, say, you know, acted like Mother Teresa or donated and helped world hunger or something and tried to maximize global happiness over their own happiness, so they're creating more happiness, would they therefore be a more moral person?
I think that like what Bennett would say is that the more happiness you produce, the more moral you are, although he doesn't make this distinction between like happiness for yourself and happiness for other people. He tends to think that you sort of produce happiness in general, and some of it comes to you and some of it comes to other people, but he doesn't really think about, well, what happens when there's a conflict between, what if you can make everybody else in the world really, really, really happy in the process of making yourself miserable? Or what if you could be a lot more happy personally if you sort of do things to please yourself and ignoring other people or just benefiting them a little bit? And what Bentham says is you look at the total amount of happiness without regard to distribution. But as a matter of fact, it looks like, practically speaking, for most people, spending all your time trying to make other people happy, you can create more happiness that way, but you tend to make yourself less happy than you could otherwise be. So that, I mean, that is this problem. We'll look at this with Mill too, and that how much utilitarianism doesn't really give you any practical guidance into how much you should focus on yourself and how much you should focus on other people. Or it looks like what it tells you to do is make yourself miserable in service of the greater good, which many people think it's too demanding. And we'll look at this when we come to Peter Singer. So, when you're thinking about the pleasure an action would produce, you want to look at several different factors. So intensity, like how intense is the pleasure that this action will produce. So think about sex, right? Really, really intense pleasure for about maybe 10 seconds, right? So really intense pleasure, but the duration not so much. Maybe you got some afterglow or pillow talk or whatever that's part of that. But you think about really, really intense, shooting heroin, right? You get your high and you feel great for I don't know how long the heroin high lasts, but you're high and then you go down and you crash and you feel lousy. But you get these really intense pleasures, but sometimes they're not that long-lived. So you have to think about the duration. So you think about the pleasure you get from, say, a friendship. A friendship isn't like quite like the ecstasy of sex, but it's, you know, it's something that lasts over time, and it gives you a certain, you know, pleasant sensation. You might say the same thing about romance, right? After you're married for a while, sex isn't as fun, and, you know, it's not what it used to be when you're courting, and all those crazy brain chemicals that they study that make you feel in love, they kind of settle down, and you get some new kind of bonding brain chemicals that come in there, and you settle into, you know, the long-term relationship. It's not quite as intense. You don't, like, have problems eating and sleeping, and you don't think about your beloved every moment, waking moment. But you have this sort of, you know, settled feeling of comfort and security and love, and that's a different sort of thing. So it's longer duration, and so this is why many people suggest that infatuation is one thing, but a long-term relationship is another, and that people really shortchange themselves when they hop from bed to bed to bed. And maybe, you know, when they're young, that's all right, you sow some wild oats. But after a while, the idea is that if you want to do the right thing, you want to find that special someone and settle down. Now, you know, Mill or Bentham would say, you don't want a long-term relationship because there's something wrong with, like, experiencing a bunch of pleasure or a bunch of variety of pleasure with having sex with a bunch of different people. It's just that overall, over the course of your life, you don't want to be bed-hopping when you're, like, 50 years old because, you know, that choices aren't as great, there's not as much variety unless you've got a lot of money or something like that, or you're a movie star. But you're missing out on something. You're missing out on the wonderful feeling of having your soulmate, of being in a really worthwhile relationship. And you can't get that over, you know, one-night stands. And so that's why you should avoid the one-night stands and settle down with someone. It's because of this idea of the long-term relationship and all the pleasure it brings. Not as intense, but longer duration. Fecundity. And this actually fits in nicely with the friendship and the romance. Fecundity means the capacity of a pleasure for growing other pleasures. So if you have like the pleasure of friendship, the pleasure of friendship might what sort of other pleasure might develop from friendship? Well, sometimes romance, I guess. But can you think? What about who here loves to exercise? Anybody though? Okay. You derive pleasure out of exercising? Or you just said something. So if you enjoy exercising, then that's something that's pleasurable, but also leads to other pleasures, right? What other pleasures might exercise lead to?
Stronger.
Being stronger, right? Healthier, living longer, looking good, right? You know? Maybe help you with the ladies or the gentlemen, right? So you sort of makes you feel more sexy, right? Think about all the things that when you're like in really, really tip-top condition, you know, stroke your ego, the vanity a little bit, right? You think, hey, I look pretty good, damn good, right? You feel so exercise. You might, you know, people that they get pleasure of, like, you know, I see these people like at 5 o'clock in the morning running in the rain. I think that person has a whole different idea of pleasure than I do. But if they get pleasure from that, they get that pleasure plus all the other pleasures that come from being healthy and in shape and fit and so on. So at least other pleasures. Friendship might lead to a good business deal. Like some of the best business deals that come from networking. And so you have a friend who's in one business and you're another, and maybe your friend runs into someone that says, I could really use someone who's, you know, someone for this. Like the movie biz works like this a lot. You could say, hey, you know, I'm doing this film shoot and I could really use like someone who knows lighting. Or I need someone that understands, that can operate like a Steadicam. And like, hey, I know this guy, he's like this community college professor who's got some skills there, you know, and he wants to get in the movie biz. And so they you know, float the name, and pretty soon, you know, you're doing big Hollywood movies. And there's lots of stories about that. So, but it starts out with a friendship, which is good in itself, and it brings pleasure in itself, but it leads to other things. And it's not like you're looking for people to make friends with just because you want to, you know, get something out of it. The friendship is what the friendship is, but the friendship leads to other things. So ideally, he says you want to find these pleasures that are fecund or fertile. Now the opposite of that, I guess, is the infertile pleasures, or the pleasures which have the capacity for creating bad things, like shooting heroin, right? That could lead to addiction, imprisonment, destroyed relationships, and bad, you know, health problems, right? All sorts of bad things. And those are what makes shooting heroin wrong, is that it leads to bad, unpleasurable consequences, or unpleasant consequences. John Stuart Mill. So Mill is the person whose name is usually associated with utilitarianism. He's the one that really developed it into a system. So Bentham's the founder, but Mill's the person that most people think of when they think about utilitarianism. And he wrote this book called utilitarianism, which answers all the objections of critics and gives a bunch of arguments in favor of it. And he's regarded as one of the greatest philosophers of all time. And Bentham's sort of seen as, you know, someone who's interesting historically, but not really. He really didn't do a lot to develop utilitarianism into a full-fledged philosophy, and Mill did. And so Mill today, when you think about utilitarianism, people think John Stuart Mill. They don't think Jeremy Bentham. So he developed, his name is usually associated with utilitarianism. Sorry, still writing here. His name, not Bentham's, is synonymous with utilitarianism today. Maybe my notes should be less verbose. Music appreciation next door or something. Your piano. Okay. So objections. So one of the objections that Mill faces is that utilitarianism is a crass hedonistic philosophy. So like I said before, if happiness is really the only value, then it seems that what should you do with your time? Play video games. Eat pizza. Yeah. Drink energy drinks. Work as little as possible. Maybe what you want to do is like get a job in like a place that rents video games and movies. And so you work there and you find a place maybe ideally with like a slacker boss, maybe like a close personal friend. And then so you work at this place that rents movies and video games. So you can get all the video games and movies for free. And ideally, it's like right next to a pizza place, and you get to know the pizza guys, and maybe you show up like at the end, or if they have a pizza that like was ordered but the person canceled or like didn't answer the door, you maybe get some free pizza, or maybe the pizza falls out of the back of the delivery truck or whatever, right? So you got some deal where you're like maximizing things. And so then what you do is like you slack at the video store watching movies and dealing with customers occasionally, and then you go home and play video games and watch movies. And just like slack, maybe smoke some dope or, you know, whatever. You think about like all the things you can do that's pleasurable. It's just like the life of a slacker. Or whatever your vision is of like kind of goofing off and not doing anything productive. So what do you think about that as a criticism? Or actually, maybe one more thing. So Mill, let's see. Let's stop there. And we'll deal with Mill's reply in a minute. So what do you think? He's a hedonist, right? Utilitarianism is a hedonistic philosophy. It says the only thing that matters is pleasure. Well, what kind of philosophy? Is that a philosophy for an educated person, for a cultured person, for someone who thinks that someone who likes to think? Or is it a philosophy for a blue-collar rube? Yeah.
Sure, why not? I mean, like, when you educate the philosophy, I mean, the more you educate you are, the wider your understanding of pleasure is. I mean, obviously, somebody who's like good based high school education would be happy with that video game life. However, people, for example, college graduates would be like, okay, I would like to see my name published because that would be a great pleasure. So you can endorse that, or like, I want to see the world. We'll be working towards that. I mean, so the more you get your idea, your horizons expand, but you're still going for the pleasure. And different people have different understanding of pleasure. My understanding of pleasure might be incredibly different from yours, or the other person. There are some very base pleasures, but they're not necessarily what drives everybody. There are some high forms of pleasures that you get, right?
Isn't that because people like prize knowledge and culture? It's not because they find the things pleasurable. Like, what's more pleasurable? Like reading a philosophy book, or like getting really, really drunk at a football game, say. But that was a pleasure which some people in this very room may have engaged in a short time ago. At least I hear reports from other faculty members about students showing up for test Friday hungover, right? So what's more pleasurable? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that for like this art and stuff like that, and philosophy, poetry, history, and all that, pleasure also can be gotten from connections. Normally, like, I personally find artwork pleasurable when I can form a connection between what the artist was trying to portray and what I'm perceiving. You know, same thing as with philosophy or with poetry. This is if you can form a connection between the person who wrote it and yourself, you know, you derive pleasure from that, you know, having a kinship that you share an understanding with them.
But isn't it more entertaining to, like, go watch a movie with lots of explosions and automatic weapons fire and special effects and snappy dialogue?
I think sharing connections between people is pretty powerful.
Okay, what about, like, a gross-out comedy? Well, people, some guy having sex with an apple pie or something, right? Or what? Jackass 3D? Come on. How fun is that? Or you say, oh well, you know, I could either go watch Jackass 3D, or I could, I could read Mills. I could read actually all about Jeremy Bentham because my interest was piqued in philosophy class, which is going to be more pleasurable. Yeah.
Well, if you do those more pleasurable things, more often they become cliche, and so it's about, you maximize your pleasure by variety.
Variety. So, well, what about like a variety of base pleasures? Like you get the gross out movie, and maybe go like see a torture porn movie, like, you know, Saw 6 is out or something like that. And then maybe you'd like watch a football game, and then maybe like, I don't know, play some video games where you're like, you know, blowing up stuff with a joystick. Or maybe if you like, you know, romance novels or whatever, you read The Bodice Ripper. I think that the argument is that this is this crass philosophy that appeals to people's baser instincts. And then when people say, oh, but what about art and culture and literature? Well, those are different values. Those aren't hedonistic values. People find pleasure in those, but do they find the most pleasure? If those people really believe they should do what brings them the most pleasure, they'd be eating and getting drunk and having sex with strangers, because those are the things that make people happy. So the argument went. Now, Mill, I think, would agree with some of you people that some pleasures are better than others, and that there some of these pleasures he calls higher pleasure. So pleasures might be different. They can be graded quantitatively or qualitatively. And so he says, if you have like a pleasure of, say, going to an art museum or going to like the art gallery here at LCC. I saw this wonderful, it's like a picture of a bronze sculpture, and they have like the clay model there. And it's this woman, and she's flying down with these big angel wings, and it's like sort of like a snapshot of her in various stages of flying down from a perch, and she lands and sloughs off the wings. This is this beautiful piece. And I was looking at it, I was like staring, like, whoa, this is like so cool, and it's saying so much to me, and it's, you know, like, what is this about? And like, wow, this is, and it like really struck me like an emotional chord. And usually, you know, it takes a really good work of art to do that. Usually I'm not, you know, struck by a piece of art unless it's really, really good. But this is one of the things that kind of grabs you by the throat. I'm like, hey, this is really cool. And I ran into one of my students who's an artist, and we were talking about it. And so that was like a great experience. And that's a pleasure. And it's not like there's this art value apart from my pleasure value, but that was a pleasure, and it's the sort of pleasure you don't get from watching automatic weapons fire and snappy dialogues and stuff blowing up and spaceships flying around, unless it's, you know, unless it's kind of an arty space explosion movie. Sometimes you get these sort of high concept sci-fi movies that have some philosophical content to them. Or even the action movie occasionally. So this is different than Bentham's calculus, where you just count quantity. He says you also have to count quality. And so some pleasures are better than others. Not all pleasures are created equal. I'm sorry. Different from Bentham's calculus. I should have covered the whole thing. Some pleasures are better than others. Quality versus quantity. Different from Bentham. So here's what Mill's defense. He says, it's better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. So what do you think he means by this? Yeah.
I didn't agree with that totally, because how do you know what a pig is thinking if he's down there in that cool puddle of mud, slopping around, and he's feeling all this pleasure, and he doesn't know anything else, as opposed to somebody with this intellect that's experienced caviar and, you know, raw tuna and whatever. And I see the differences, but I don't think there could be a difference in happiness just because one's got more education than the other.
So maybe how do you know how happy the pig is?
Right, how do you know how happy the pig is? Maybe he's in heaven. Maybe he's in total bliss.
Yeah.
I feel like you'd be happier if you didn't know things. It's like, I don't know, say like with religion, when people start thinking about it, like, oh, this is scary, we actually live in this. But then like, if you totally believe in it and you're oblivious to whatever else, like, you're happy to continue.
Yeah, the pig doesn't like lay awake at night staring at the feeling, wondering how he's going to pay his mortgage, or whether there's a God or not, or you know what he's going to do about a wayward piglet or something, right? who can't stay out of piggy jail or something. I mean, he doesn't have problems. I for a short time I worked with developmentally disabled adults. Most of them were in their 20s, but we referred them to them as the kids, and they had childlike mentality. And to them, every day was like Christmas. And it wasn't like they didn't have squabbles and problems, but they were much less than adults did. And you know, they were being taken care of, and we'd go on field trips. And there was one kid; his dad was like a middle manager. And so, what did this kid like to do? He liked to buy office supplies and like make little reports and you know, write out memos and stuff like that to be like his dad. And you know, and he enjoyed himself, and there were, you know, other kids that had their things that they did. And you think about when you were a kid, if you had a good childhood, people tend to look back on their childhood as a kind of a happy, carefree time, unless they had like sort of bad family problems going on and so on. Maybe that's a thing in the past. But so if you could think, if your tastes were simpler, if your desires were simpler, would you, you know, necessarily be happier? And Mill says you would be, but it doesn't mean you'd be in a better state. Because here's another thought experiment: would you suppose you could have an operation done in your brain that would give you an IQ of like 70, like of a child again, and you'd be that way the rest of your life? And you could be put in a facility where you'd be taken care of. Who here would do that? Oh, why not? You'd be happier, right? Every day would be Christmas. You'd be taken care of. You'd have like people that would care for you. Suppose it's part of the scientific experiment, right? They want to see, okay, we're going to operate this on your brain. We're going to turn you. We're going to make you severely retarded, and then we're going to sort of watch what you do. But there's going to be people there to take care of you and love you, and you'll be in this facility, and there'll be like a playground, and you'll have like all the toys you want. Yeah.
But you still say surrendering the capacity for higher wishful pleasure down the road. I mean, you're still sacrificing something. So better would be a who would you rather be, a Stephen Hawking, who's basically wheelchair bound, having to most people stand like kind of hard life, or would you like to be Ron Jeremy? Stephen Hawking, either or. I mean, I'd say about 90% would go with Ron Jeremy first, rather than Stephen Hawking.
90% would?
Oh, I think so. All like, well, women will treat that the same thing, but
right.
Put in your like time address, for example. Like,
right.
Somebody who's kind of great life, but nowhere near the intellect of Stephen Hawking.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So anyway, his point, not all pleasures are created equally. Now, here's his argument, that there's a difference between the quality of a pleasure and the quantity of pleasure. So the quality is like, think about quality like if you're going to order pizza. Like, not all pizzas create equal, right? You can get like Little Caesars for like a cheese pizza for $5, or you could get like some gourmet pizza that's like might cost you $20, right? And that gourmet pizza, there's a lot more that goes into it. It's a higher quality of pizza. And you know, one might taste like cardboard and doesn't reheat well, and the other stuff is just, you know, delicious. And so, in the same way, there's certain pleasures, and it's not, but he says it's not the quantity. Like, it's not like you can get like four Little Caesars pizzas for $20, or you can have one gourmet pizza. And there's a difference of the gourmet pizza, you'd have less pizza, but it would be of a higher quality. In the same way, Mill says, you can go out there and have sex with a whole bunch of strangers and get drunk every night for the rest of your life and just go out and gamble and carouse and just, you know, indulge all these base blue-collar pleasures. But that's not going to be the same as the higher quality of appreciating a work of art or reading good literature or doing philosophy. That's why Socrates, at the end of each of his dialogues, walks away dissatisfied. He can't figure out the nature of virtue or the nature of justice or the nature of knowledge. But there's something worthwhile in the endeavor that makes him come back and try again, even though he ends up being dissatisfied a lot of times. Why? Because knowledge is a higher quality pleasure. A pleasure regarding knowledge or intellectual pleasures are a higher quality pleasure than physical pleasures. So his distinction here is between higher and lower pleasures. So higher pleasures are intellectual pleasures, cultural pleasures, the pleasures of going to the opera. You know, does the opera have a beat? Can you dance to it? Not really. But is there something, is there something about the opera? The opera's not more pleasurable, Mill says, but the pleasure is more valuable. And it's kind of a funny distinction, but he says, it's not like if you compare the pleasure of opera with the pleasure of going to a Lady Gaga concert or something, right? And suppose you like Lady Gaga. So you're thinking about the two. Well, they're different kinds of pleasures. It's not, you might get more pleasure from the Lady Gaga concert, but the opera one counts for more. And he would say, if you've been exposed to opera at all, you're going to gravitate towards the opera. You might go to like a pop music concert occasionally, but you're going to gravitate towards the intellectual and cultural stuff if you're an educated person. The same thing about lower pleasures, he says, tend to have to do with the body or physicality, maybe to some degree sort of baser emotions. There's the common blue-collar pleasures of the uneducated masses. Professional wrestling, right? So, you know, you look at wrestling and like, that is not a higher pleasure. It's, yeah.
But wrestling is just American theater.
Okay, well, but then there's different kinds of theater, right? There's vaudeville and there's Shakespeare. And there's different kinds of dancing. There's burlesque and there's ballet. And Mill would say, the culture person might want to go down to the dance hall and check out the dancing girls, but then he's also going to want to go to the ballet. And now, if base pleasure was all that mattered, he would never go to the ballet. He'd always want to see the dancing girls at the dance hall with the skimpy outfits and the, you know, provocative gyrations, right? Because that appeals to his animal instinct. But ballet appeals to the spiritual and the aesthetic, which isn't more pleasurable, but it kind of somehow it counts for more. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. According to Mill. So his idea is that you need more. Criticism of Mill. So some objections. One is this kind of elitist. So what do you think about this? That elitist, classist, and ethnocentric. To use some jargony words that are popular in the sociology department. So elitist, it's sort of, you know, for the upper crust. It's classist, it's for people, the educated classes of which Mill is a part. You know, Mill had his father teaching him ancient Greek when he's 5 years old. Right? He's a kind of spoiled rich kid. Educated in a wealthy family, his father's a lawyer, and he thinks, well, you know, Western culture and higher learning is where it's at, and you know, such a person would think might sneer at lower examples of lower culture, peasant dishes. Folk dancing, right? That's, you know, that's a lower pleasure. Well, maybe not to like the people that like the peasants, right? The peasants have their folk dances and their you know, traditional recipes, and that's what they enjoy. Should they enjoy foie gras or whatever, you know, this fancy gourmet food? Yeah.
And he doesn't quite work because, for example, back in those days, folk dancing was a piece of pleasure than something else. Nowadays, the same exact folk dancing is considered a high pleasure because it's so rare and so unusual. You go to the theater, it's exactly the same act. It's just a difference. I mean, for him to be, it has to be there. It has to be the same, basically. I mean, for his theory to work, it cannot, you know, same exact act has to be based on it once, no matter how. I think for him, for his theory to be, it has to be consistency.
Sure.
Something has to be constant. And in his thing, nothing's constant. So.
That's a good point. There's actually a French dish called ratatouille, which originally is a peasant dish, right? And now it's like this gourmet thing. But it's, you know, it's the same dish. It's some kind of like porridge. There's a Pixar movie or something about it, right? Actually, it's a pretty good movie. But it's all about this. But it's about this. It gets its name from this peasant dish, which today it's a gourmet dish, but it's the same exact dish. So there's maybe a bit of relativism there. And also just when, you might also argue that what you enjoy really depends on sort of how you were raised and what you're conditioned to find pleasure in. Mm-hmm. Tony.
We read something about it. I think Boston, the ship workers there, had in their contract, written in their contract, that they could only be paid in lobster so many days, or fed lobster so many days a week, because they didn't want to, you know, have to eat the same meal all the time, be paid in
right.
Butter, which is a delicacy in most parts of the country.
Uh-huh.
And they had in the contract they would only accept so much. So yeah, it's all everything.
Every time I turn around, it's the president eats more lobster someplace. Yeah, so it's, people. That's a good example of like if you have something enough. It's sort of what counts as hoity-toity and elite, and what counts as sort of base and pedestrian might depend on your circumstance and the cultural conditions which change too. Whereas what was low class before becomes high class. Like, to take another example, many hymns that you might sing in church on a Sunday morning originally were English drinking songs. And they were adopted and put the organ music, and all of a sudden they become church hymns. Okay, so we'll do more on utilitarianism on Monday. Talk some more about Mill and put out some utilitarian dilemmas for you.